This episode is brought to you by the House of Chanel.
For Gabrielle Chanel, reading was a refuge which allowed her to invent her own destiny right from childhood. Literature became a passion she shared with the love of her life, Boy Capel, and her friends like Cocteau Colette, Pierre Reverdy, and Max Jacob. She helped the authors she admired without them knowing. She read for inspiration and then became an inspiration herself. Watch the film Gabrielle Chanel and Literature at InsideChanel.com.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your crispy cut skin of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. I feel nice. I have never felt so much urgency to discuss Mariah Carey as I do right now. As you likely know, Mariah recently put out a memoir called The Meaning of Mariah Carey, written with Michaela Angela Davis. I wrote about it a couple weeks ago. Mariah has made great podcast fodder previously. And so on this week's episode, we are going to catch up with Mariah at MC30. The 30th anniversary of her debut album. Just get a little faint thinking about Vision of Love. Even now, Mariah is incredibly important to me as a young person. Her music was central to my understanding of pop. Her version of I'll Be There on the MTV Unplugged series with Trey Lorenz is just one of my favorite pieces of music of all time. And I'm committed to high-level Mariah discourse. It's why I thought so hard about the book, and it's why on this week's episode, we are going to talk to Allison Davis. Allison wrote a long feature about Mariah, got to spend time with Mariah in Bedford a few weeks ago. So we're going to talk to Allison. And later in the episode, the gang is here, Karen Gans, Joe Coscarelli. We are all going to talk about the Mariah Carey 1990s rock record that came up in the memoir and has been the subject of much internet conversation in the weeks since. But first, I think when we look back at 2020, at this Mariah moment, there's only one story that people are going to read, and that is Allison Davis with the big interview in New York Magazine. Allison is a features writer at New York Magazine in The Cut. And of course, you know Allison Davis is on Popcast. Allison!
Hey!
Long time, podcast. first time, right?
It's true. It's true. I'm not ashamed to admit that I've been waiting for this invitation for some time, John. So
I'm
thank
not
you.
Ashamed to admit that that makes me happy to hear. So, Allison, before we get into the Mariah thing, we should just underscore something, which is for the last like 2-3 years, you've been on a little bit of a tear from a feature writing perspective, and people should check those stories out if they have not. If they're not up on it, they should just get the Google situation happening. Look on your Twitter. Allison's been putting in work. So just keep that in mind. We're not coming cold. This is not someone who walked into Mariah cold. Allison's been here doing the work. So that's the first thing. That said, has anything that you've done in your career to this point prepared you for sitting down with Mariah Carey? Oh. Let's start there.
Good question. I can point to two things that maybe have prepared me for this moment. One was Michael B. Jordan that I did for GQ.
Yes. Hello to our friends at Gentleman's Quarterly.
Yes. Hello, friends.
Hello, friends.
My gentleman friends.
Yes.
So Michael B. Jordan, it's not that I had like a, listen, he's like a really hot guy.
And yeah, I'm
the product of like all girls education from the age of 5 through college. So like
wow.
Sometimes I know.
Okay. So I didn't even know all that.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know all that. Okay.
This is
all right.
Podcast After Dark. You're getting
this
the
really
real,
is. No, this is great. This is, I'm going to start introducing a segment in every episode where people have to talk about their childhood traumas that led them to the point in their career where they were able to achieve the thing that then got them on Popcast. So that's yours. Okay, great. Good start.
Right.
Good first segment.
So hot men occasionally make me very nervous. And then you have to like learn how to just be like, no, you're not, you know, hot Michael B. Jordan. You're just some guy that I have to trick into telling me things about yourself. So like learning some like Jedi mind tricks to quell nerves was clutch in that one. And then Cardi B, which was my first official cover story for New York Magazine in the cut, because like the art of just waiting patiently.
Oh yeah.
And like not freaking out and like not thinking, oh my God, I've been waiting for 4 hours. It means I'm not going to get the interview. This is just like realizing once you're like on the cruise ship, you just cede all power and learning how to stay calm in that. That was kind of a...
No, that's a real thing. Like I once waited for Ghostface Killa in Miami for 2 days.
Woo!
Largely in the lobby of the apartment building where he was staying. And I didn't, in fact, get that story. I had to return to Miami the week later when I did actually talk to him. And even and that day, of course, it was like 5 hours after it was supposed to be. But it's a good story because it's like, of course, it's a good story to wait in a lobby for with Ghostface. I mean, for Ghostface Killa for 2 days. But also that thing about patience and certainly like, you know, like chasing rappers around early in my career where like nothing ever happened exactly in the way that it was supposed to happen. It did teach me that, like, number one, you will get something. And number two, you have to make something of what you get, even if it's not the thing that you thought you were going to get.
Yes, that's a great point. It's like our version of Almost Famous, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think also it reminded me because I used to think I had like 10 things. I was like, I have to extract these, whatever these things are, I have to extract them. Otherwise, the story's a bust. And then you realize, no, it's like you make the best version of the story that's presented to you and that you're able to achieve. And that can be as good, if not better, as the thing you went in there thinking you wanted to do. So
absolutely.
It's helpful. Okay. So what you're saying is calming your nerves and accepting essentially your helplessness prepared you to interview Mariah Carey. Exactly. Am I reading that right?
Yes. Okay. That's perfect. Yes.
Now, in the beginning of your piece, you really do set a vibe because really what you're talking about is what's happening around Mariah, this kind of bubble. And obviously part of that's Corona because obviously here we are. You did it, I assume, maybe in August, kind of July or August.
It was August. Yeah.
August. Yeah. So obviously, you know, we're all still dealing with Corona and quarantine and whatnot. But the Mariah bubble exists independent of pandemic. That seem right?
Yeah.
Okay. Talking about the bubble. And then being allowed to slip inside.
I have to give my editors at New York Magazine a lot of credit. At a certain point, I was like, I don't want to be too close to these, what I imagine are going to be tense negotiations to get me into this bubble, because I don't want to walk through the door and then be like, there's the writer who just like wouldn't, was such a little asshole. So, oh, sorry.
That's all right.
No, okay. Profanity number one.
Yeah. I got to find a bell in this room somewhere and just start dinging you every time.
Take a shot every time I slip up and curse.
It is after dark. Pedro, did you get a beer? Pedro, did you get a beer for this?
I'm sipping on it right now.
Phenomenal. Allison, did you have a mimosa or were you just teasing?
Oh, no. So what I've done, I didn't have any champagne or orange juice. Okay. So I have red wine and Coca-Cola, which is kind of the same thing.
Wow.
It's a nighttime mimosa.
I got to be honest, like as a non-drinker, that almost sounds exciting to me. That almost sounds like I would try that.
It's delicious. Just everyone should know.
Damn. Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm going to file that away. I just have them here with the cod and the broccoli, which is spectacular and a little slice into the intimacy of my life these days.
That anyway. Drink is now officially known as the Allison, by the way.
Pedro, thank
that's
you.
That's big. We're going to put that on Twitter. It's going to be big on Twitter for sure. For sure. Okay. So you had your negotiations done for you, which is a thing that obviously happens sometimes in big celebrity interviews and access and so on and so forth. Yeah. So you come in cold. You're just like, ooh, little old me. I don't know anything that happened before this exact moment, right?
Right. If somebody pissed you off, it's not me.
It wasn't me. Of course.
Pleading sense.
Okay. How did they greet you? What did you perceive?
Well, you know, it was really strange because of COVID, and this was my first in-person interview since March. So I had antibodies, so I had like my documentation for that. And
oh,
then
did you have COVID?
I did, yeah, in March. So
I'm so sorry.
Oh, you know, it was pretty mild for me.
Okay,
it was
well, just I'm glad
like,
to hear
you know,
that.
I know, thank you, yeah. So I had my antibody documentation. I got tested like again closer to the date. And then I had to find a testing location that would get me my results in like a time frame that would make them feel secure, but also was like fast enough. She has someone that's immunocompromised in her sort of bubble. So I think that everyone was just like super nervous about, and they hadn't had any outsiders since like everyone since March. And so everyone was very wary. But when I got there, it was like they were so happy to have a new person. So like, you know, Mariah was off doing her Mariah thing and on the phone or on a Zoom, which now has been revealed with this Apple Christmas special, sort of plotting all of the big stuff she's doing. And then it was just me and like her team, which is, you know, her close friends and like the people that she rolls with the most, you know, her tour manager, her house manager, her makeup artist. And they're all just like happy to have a new soul. So there was lots of conversation and like they really did make me cookies without me asking. And like, it was great. I kept joking, like, I'm not going to leave. And I think I made the joke so many times that they were like, please make sure she leaves.
Yes, literally. Like, we're going to leave her in like some other room just to be like, hey, we'll be right back. And then someone else will like escort her from the premises.
Exactly. But it was weird, like walking up, you know, this huge driveway in upstate New York with my mask on. And it was late because it was like, you know, past 10. And
she's in Bedford, right? She's in Bedford or near Bedford. Yeah, right. And do you feel like entourages all kind of take on different rhythms? Every celebrity entourage is kind of its own. There are some that are kind of extraordinarily protective of their center, you know, of their hero, of the boss. And there are some that are kind of like, it's familial. Where did this kind of fall on that spectrum? Did you vibe?
I think familial, like super familial, in the way that like they would let little like anecdotes or like talk a little shit about Mariah in like a good natured way without sort of realizing that like, oh no, we're the entourage and this is the press. Like once you're sort of in the orbit, like you are part of the family and they all just sort of, it was cute. I like really liked the, especially because like I've been isolated for so long. It was very nice to be like, oh, look, all my new friends. The short friend's so good.
Over the years, Mariah as an interview subject, I feel like has been alternately pretty transparent, but on the other hand, like kind of like almost theatrically icy in some instances. And obviously, like in a weird way, there is not a lot of like long form narrative journalism about Mariah Carey, which I think is like speaks ill of like, say, the music press in the 90s and the 2000s. But, you know, we can punt that for another conversation. Sometimes she is, especially when it came to like, you know, TV interviews or red carpet interviews, like she's like, sometimes just like very laser, you know, the very famous I don't know her moment and so on and so forth. Like Mariah is like giving you this rich character sometimes in interview type settings. Did it take a while in your interaction with her to get her to warm to not be that? Or was she coming in the door knowing what she needed, what she wanted to give you? Like what was the energy like when she came in?
Well, one thing that wasn't in the piece, just because I already used too many words and the scene.
That's not a thing, but okay. You know, it's not real.
And like the scene in real life just overshadowed things. But we had like a pretty lengthy Zoom call, maybe 3 or 4 days before I went to the house. Before they knew they were going to let me come to the house, we just started on Zoom. And I think because we already sort of established a rapport and because a lot of what I was told from her team about the Zoom call was like, this is just for her to feel like she can trust you. And she feels really vulnerable about this book. And so like, just like come in and like, let her talk about what she needs to talk about, which was what I would have done anyway, but it was still good advice to know that she was nervous, I suppose.
Of course. And also it's worth noting, and not to be all processy about it, but like this, I feel like I've done a version of this from time to time. And it definitely different people function differently as far as what their comfort levels are. But I do find in the times where I've done a version of what you're describing, it invariably makes the actual thing go more smoothly.
Yes. Yes. It would have been a lot harder to sort of warm her up. That sounds so perverted. If I hadn't had that like establishing Zoom, which like was a great scene into itself. Like I wish I could have included some of that. Like she really went full tilt with the lighting, you know, it was great. I loved it. Mariah knows her angles and her best lighting.
Wait, do you think she has one of those crazy ring lights and she had it like set up over the laptop screen kind of vibe?
Oh, I mean, Mariah, she's so self-aware. She knew she was just going to tell me that. So like she was like very clear, like, yes, this is where all my lighting is. We called this the Zoom room. It was like a, I guess, like an atrium off the,
yo,
off the house.
Zoom room?
The Zoom room.
The Zoom room?
The Zoom room.
Oh my God.
It's like she's got not as cool as the Moroccan room, I suppose.
I can't believe I didn't import a carpet from Marrakesh for this pot for this episode. I really like. I'm slipping. I should have done
slipping,
that.
Slipping, John.
My God. My bad.
Should have sent
bad.
One to me as well.
Real talk. Real talk.
And the funniest part was that she had someone project or put the Zoom screen up on a big television so she could see me kind of like full size, I guess. But this room was all windows, so I could see the reflection of me on Zoom. And I was like so trippy to be like looking at her, but like watching my giant head reflected in the windows behind her head. It's like, I'm so glad that was not the only scene
I had. Do you have a screen grab of that for your archives?
Of course.
Good. Okay, good. I'm just making sure. Sometimes in the moment, you can forget to grab the thing. Okay, good. So she came in. You had already kind of greased the wheels a little bit. You know, I read the book. I wrote about the book. I found the book. First of all, I found it very moving, especially the first half. I found it very, very moving. And I found it really encouraging and really nourishing. And I also thought the book pulled off this kind of unusual memoir trick that a lot of reason I try not to read too many memoirs because most memoirs are bad at this, where it somehow manages to sound spoken and written at the same time. Like many memoirs are like just so loose that you're kind of like, this is a drag. Cause it's just yammery, or they're so written. It's just clear that like someone sat for 3 hours of interviews and then somebody else like packaged it into 300 pages. This book is like very much achieves the best of both. And the co-writer, Michaela Angela Davis, I thought did a really, really sharp job. Did you feel like Mariah wanted to do the same thing with you that she was doing in the book? Did she see this as an opportunity to kind of extend the narrative of what's in the book? Or do you feel like she was using it in a slightly different way?
I feel like she was using it in a slightly different way. I think what I like love about Mariah is she has no qualms about saying, I've said that before, or like that was on, you know, page 52 of the book. So like if I would ask a question that wasn't furthering that conversation, she was like, please refer to. And I was like, oh, okay, yes. Yeah. Shit. Thank you. Yes, I will do that.
That's dope. Maybe you forgot, but I literally just wrote a book. It's like literally, it's literally a book. It's all in there.
In your hand. We sent you the PD, like you have the book. I think what she wanted out of the interview was, I guess, sort of like a companion piece, right? Like a glimpse into what it felt like to be somebody who, yes, had been saying some of this stuff the whole time, but also was like really putting out a new version of herself and like a new depth to her trauma and her experience. And she was just nervous. And I think she wanted to like let people know that like, yes, the memoir is fun and it's like it can be dishy and it can be all the things that we expect from Mariah as like a pop star and a diva. But like this was a big step for her to like put this out there and that she had like still had a lot of emotions around it. And so she couldn't write some meta memoir where she was like, I'm very nervous to be telling you this. And I think she wanted people to see those nerves.
Pedro, we haven't played any music. Let's just play an early Mariah song that was very meaningful to me as a young person. Let's listen to a little bit of I Don't Wanna Cry.
Once again, we sit in silence. After all is said and done, only emptiness inside. Baby, look what we've become. We can make a million promises, but we still won't change. It isn't right to stay together when you only bring each other.
Look, you profile a lot of people. I'm sure you've had varying levels of either interest in or appreciation for their art. Sometimes you got to profile someone and you're like, maybe they're not that interesting. What's your relationship to Mariah, the music, Mariah, the videos, the performances? Like, when was Mariah on your radar when you were younger? And what did Mariah kind of resonate for you as at that time?
John, you're going to make me fangirl so hard right now.
I'm a fangirl right after. It's fine. Like, it's this is what we're doing here. It's fine.
My parents tell the story, and I don't think it's probably, like, not that true, but, like, I'll take it. That, like, I would be, like, in the car with them, and they'd be listening to the radio, and, like, whenever Mariah's song came on, I would apparently sing along pitch perfectly with all of the words, even before I was literate. No, that's, like, not true. But, you know, parents love to do that.
That's,
but,
like, when my mom says, I got, like, a 1900 on the SAT. It's all right. It's, like, it's like, true enough. It's right. True enough.
Let them build the mythology for us,
fine.
Right?
It's fine.
But, like, as long as I've
and
known...
And that was when the SATs were 1600, just for, you know, just for clarity's purpose.
You were all the way up to 11, even then. Look at that.
True story.
But, like, truly, for as long as I've been, like, aware of music, like, Mariah's songs have been in my life, which is just crazy to think of a career that's run along with my lifetime. And I remember I had this whole graph that they made me cut because I guess it was too effusive, where, like... To me, I feel like Mariah has such personal attachment to all of her songs, and she's telling us stories about herself in all of her songs. But every Mariah song that you listen to, you have your own memory that sort of, like, erases hers, right? Like, My All for Her was about Derek Jeter and escaping her terrible marriage to Tommy Mottola. But, like, to me, I'm like, oh my God, that is Bert and Daniel's sixth grade mixer. Like, wow. You know, like, powder blue tube top from Victoria's Secrets, like, just hoping for a slow dance. Like, it calls to mind such visceral memories that, like, Mariah's music just means so much to me and to her and to everyone. So it's crazy
so
to them.
We are going to take you back to 1998. Here's My All by Mariah Carey, Bert and Daniel. Hit the line.
Does he deserve a mention in this? I don't even know.
I'd give my all to have just one more night with you. I'd risk my life to be.
A thing that was interesting, basically, like, where I said, if I didn't talk about that person, they didn't matter.
Yes.
And I will say, like, I mostly believe that. I do think this book is obviously, like, heavily weighted towards her youth and the early phase of her career. And basically, like, the last, like, 10 or 15 years, it feels like it was kind of racing through. So I can't presume about the people who are in her life later in the later part of her career and whether they mattered or not. But I do know that those people were either raced past or ignored altogether. Maybe there's, like, a memoir part two, you know, 5 years from now, where we get into the 2000s and the 2010s.
The good stuff, yeah.
But, like, I mean, sorry to James Packer and Eminem, basically.
I know. Yeah, right? They did not mean anything to her, apparently.
You can control F all you want. You will not find anything.
I mean, that's the first thing I did when I got that PDF was control F Eminem. Because he, you know, I hate to say it, but he was, like, so nervous. Oh, what's she, reportedly, like, what's she going to say about me? And, like, as a single woman, there is no greater joy than, like, thinking this, like, this man thinking, oh, she's going to say something about me. I'm so nervous. She's going to dog me. And then it's like, you just don't matter. Mic drop. So good. Mariah. Mwah.
Also, like, not to turn this into a podcast about Eminem, because we won't do that.
No.
But for all the things that Eminem has accomplished, and also for all the things that Eminem has been pilloried for, it's notable that there even was a micro press cycle, presumably including input from someone on Eminem's team, about whether Mariah Carey would dog him in her memoir.
Right.
Like, that's, like, I'm not saying that their relationship or whatever isn't important or wasn't important or whatever, but it's like, is it, like, top 5 or top 10 things that Eminem should be thinking about in the year 2020? Like, I don't, maybe not, but yet here we are.
Here we are.
Anyway, that was just a sidebar. So talk about the elusive chanteuse. You know what I mean? Talk about the energy. She's looking you in the eye. She's, like, looking to the sky. She's, like, on FaceTime at the same time. Like, what's she giving? You know what I mean? Like, what's she giving you from an intensity perspective?
As you mentioned, so I don't have to feel, like, cocky for saying this, but I have done a fair number of these by now. And I will say that Mariah was one of the most generous interview subjects when she didn't really have to be, you know, like, you could just, like, sit in a room with Mariah for an hour and, like, have her sort of ignore you, and, like, you could still write 6,000 words. But she was invested in this going well. And so she was so warm and like so generous and so, I don't want to say eager to please, but she just really wanted to get it right. So she was careful and thoughtful and persistent, and it was, it felt like so intimate, which I hope came across in the piece. And also just like, because she was like at home and like with all of her people, and her kids had just like done this little celebration for her, and it just felt like she had felt safe to be so open.
Are you things that you learned from the book that you were surprised by and then kind of engaged with her on and had kind of surprising or provocative interactions about?
I don't know why I was like so hung up on like the, like what the roof and my all, I think, cause that was like, those you're are my
messy.
Favorite.
Allison, you're messy.
I am. It's true. I'm so sorry. I am chaotic. Good. Thank you.
I am lawful neutral. I don't know what you're talking about.
I really like love that she was like, I'm going to give you this gossip. And, but then I liked how she engaged with it, where she was like, listen, like, it wasn't some great intellectual romance. And I was like, you have such a nice way of saying sort of a mean thing about a person. It was like,
but she's got years of experience.
Yeah, it's true. It's like legendary shade throwing. It was so good. But so like, that was one where I was surprised to read it in the book. And then I was like, I must gossip with you more about this. But she was like pretty coy, except, you know, to say not my great intellectual romance.
Dieter was unavailable for comment.
I did try, and he was. And then I also think it was interesting, you know, she talks about her family in the book a lot, her sisters and her brother, and it's tough to read, and it's tough to think about a child like dealing with that from their family.
Horrific.
And then to talk to her about it in person, it could have been another moment where she punted it to be like, that was in the book, please, you know, look at chapter X, Y, Z. But she was just sort of willing again to say the truth about it, which was like, I've tried. And like, it sucks that I have to cut my family out, but you can only do so much. And I thought that sort of like candidness and willingness to just take it even one step further, knowing that her family can be litigious. And like, that was surprising to me. I thought that that was going to be like a shutdown moment, and it wasn't.
Also, in addition to family circumstances, as far as what she endured as a young person, but also what she endures in an ongoing way, race is a huge discussion in this book. And Mariah speaking candidly about the challenges of growing up with a white mother and a black father and the identity confusion that left her with, and sort of created tension, not just in her family interactions, but eventually in her career and in her romantic life as well. My main takeaway from the book, and this is something that when I was writing about, I felt like I kept stumbling on examples in the book of this, where you'd kind of have some unfortunate circumstance in something would happen in the book. And I'd be like, okay, was that a professional thing that happened? Well, okay, it's kind of a familial thing. Okay, it's kind of a romantic thing. It's kind of a self-identity thing. And basically all of the different axes were all intersecting on so many different occasions. And seeing how she learned to navigate her identity as a young person, and seeing how that was still playing out in her 20s and in her 30s, and her marriage to Tommy Mottola, and her desire to bring hip-hop into her music when Tommy Mottola didn't want her to bring hip-hop into her music. All of those things happening at the same time, it was just like very, very loud part of the book. Like, that's the part of the book, parts of the book that were the loudest to me, when all those things were intersecting.
Yeah, I agree. And when you're sitting down to write, or when you're sitting down to think of your questions or sort of what you want the arc of an interview to be, knowing after reading the book, just like knowing how loud that was and how she was still unpacking that in some ways, you didn't want to walk into it, and you didn't want to like let the piece like make it about that. But it's impossible not to, because it is this enormous thing that affected all corners of Mariah, and that I don't think people fully understand how. Like, and I think that was the most eye-opening part of the book. Like you said, it's like, oh, everything I thought I knew about Mariah, why she was like, she pushed so hard for hip hop, or like, and then you didn't even realize the shit she was going through too, or the shit that people were saying about her. You just sort of like, it's shocking what people got away with. And I do think that of all the moments that she's starting to like get her due in ways that she hasn't before in her career, like as a songwriter, as a hit maker, like as just like a great self-aware character. Like, this was the biggest one where in 2020, we can finally look at identity in a really different way and acknowledge how screwed up it was for her. And she deserves that in her book. And I think she deserved it in this piece. So I was happy then to like sort of run headlong into it with her. Also because it's like still something she's unpacking because she has two kids, you know, like who are her biracial, and like watching them grow up and trying to help them grow up and be who they are fully. Like, she has to continuously reckon with her own childhood.
Right. And she wants to teach them about themselves in a way that she was not taught about herself.
Exactly.
Essence. Let's listen to a good Mariah hip hop moment. Let's listen to Heartbreaker with Jay-Z. Let's go.
Gotta watch it.
Let's go back. Let's go all the way back to the mid-90s when I was not yet a professional music critic. Some would say I'm not currently a professional music critic. That could go either way. Let's go back to the mid-90s when I was a fan. And I should emphasize, you had your fangirl moment. Allow me mine. I came into this realization actually when I was talking with Karen, my editor, about when I was writing this piece, maybe like mid-flow on this piece, because I had listened to a bunch of old Mariah to kind of get in the right headspace, watch some old videos, watch the Unplugged. I knew Mariah was formative for me, but I don't think I had ever conceptualized like just how formative. And probably one of the essential of my teenage years, one of the essential musical shaping influences for me as a listener. And so when I was listening back to the old stuff, I started thinking about like, how was Mariah presented in that time? And then also, what did I take from Mariah that I carry with me into my listening now? And a thing that I very much remember, and this is certainly a mid to late 90s thing, probably Fantasy Remix onward. There wasn't yet a language in at least the discourse that I was a part of. And keep in mind, I'm in college. I'm not yet out writing with writers who do it for a living. There wasn't yet a language for a pop singer who had natural hip hop tendencies or hip hop influences, who then shifted from more down the road music to music that embraced hip hop. At that time, it was actually perceived as maybe a little carpet baggy, like a little try hard. There were moments where I remember hearing people talk about these kind of like failed experiments that Mariah was doing because they weren't Dream Lover or Vision of Love or something, you know, like that she was like trying too hard. And I think what that conversation was, especially after reading like the Tommy Mottola section of this book, no one at her label was invested in her being that person, even if that person was closer to who she actually was, like on the inside. And there are so many great stories in the book of her interacting with rappers in these ways that are like completely comfortable. And then like Tommy Mottola, like freaking out about it. Like the story where she goes with the brat to get Burger King, leaving the house in Bedford. And like they send security after her, or the one that I was just thinking of earlier when we were talking about race and identity is when she's driving with Cameron up to Harlem to find the church that I believe it's either her grandmother or maybe great aunt was the head of. I forget which family member, but like Cam just like driving up the FDR drive in like maybe like a blue Lamborghini or something, going to like drive around to find this church. And these are Mariah's complete comfort zones. So in a weird way, the first 3 or 4 years of her career where she's not actively embracing that or working with that, maybe those are the outliers, not the thing that people perceived as the outliers at the time.
John, that was good.
Oh, stop. Well, I've only been thinking about it for 30 years. Jeez.
But I think you can see it in the performances, right? Like I watched The Unplugged and I watched a lot of her early performances. And yes, she was like a new performer, but she's always had confidence. And there was, I don't want to say like a stiffness, but there was like a little bit of a stiffness to her as a performer that I feel like once you get her back in her element and you watch those performances, like, it's fun. And even when I was talking to her, like, and she was telling stories about, like, the mid-90s and, like, oh, I'm backstage at, like, this award show with this rapper or this hip-hop producer. Like, that's a Mariah that sounds, like, so much fun to hang out with and just, like, party with. And you're like, all I want is a memoir of, like, that.
Oh, the one that I went Tupac was, like, at the AMAs where, like, Tupac pulled up on her?
Yes. Ooh. Like, we want all of that.
I
want
to know where. Yes. Absolutely.
Because it's, like, that's where she's coming alive, you know? And, like, it's just, I think, I do hope. And she's kind of teased it, but I don't know if she meant it, that there might be a volume two where it's just like, now that she's done the heavy stuff, she's like, well, now I can just tell all my great industry stories.
Yeah, I'll pre-order that. Hell yeah. Can we talk a little bit about fans? I feel like on Popcast, historically, we can be a little hard on fans because fan armies can be unpleasant sometimes. And I've been on the wrong side of a couple Mariah fans. You know, I reviewed the Mariah Vegas opening night. That was tough. You know, that was a challenge. And I say that as someone who, like, literally loved Mariah, you know, like, that was tough. And the fans are what the fans are. But the way that Mariah wrote about her relationship with her fans was probably, like, the most astute and sympathetic portrayal and representation of a fandom and, like, what a fandom can actually mean to a performer that I've ever read or heard any famous person describe. And I wonder if she talked about it at all or how that struck you in the book.
She kept saying, as much as she wrote the book for, like, her like, younger self and for her kids, she was writing it for the fans. And when she put in something that was, I guess there were, like, little Easter eggs in the book for fans, like little postures or ways that she says things or that, like,
darling.
But, like, she wouldn't need an audiobook for her fans to know exactly, like, how she sounded, you know, saying it, which is nice. I think, like, the Mariah's fan groups they're so interesting in their own right, her diehard fans. Like, I think Rich Juzwiak wrote a really great story about the Lambs around, like, Christmas time, maybe in 2018. And
Shout out, Rich.
What's up, Rich? Of all the Mariah fans reading this, I was, like, most afraid of what Rich thought of the piece.
we all live in fear of what Rich thinks. I know.
We just want to make you happy, Rich.
That's it. Honestly, it's true. It's true. Like, what? I might send this to him before we publish, just to make sure.
Maybe we should, actually. I should have sent him the piece. But I do feel like there is, like, a genuine and true intimacy. And, like, her fans, their loyalty is hard won because they, like, stick with Mariah through all of the ups and downs. And I feel like her ups and downs are maybe more visible than other artists for some reason. And I think that, like, if you're, like, you're in the Lamely, you're just, like, it's like the mafia or something. It's like, you know, you're, like, you're in it with your blood. And that's just so fascinating because it's enduring. And I think that her fans are, like, a little bit older than the average fan group, maybe, I would guess, just because they've, like, been there from the beginning. And she does, like, so much for them, you know, which I think is just really lovely. I went to some fan Zoom for the release of Save the Day.
Oh, okay. Yeah. For the new single. Yeah.
Yeah. For the new single. And it was, like, amazing watching them in the chat, like, quizzing each other. Like, do you know this Deep Cut Mariah Carey lyric? And if you didn't know it, like, this one guy was like, you're not a real fan. Get out of the chat. It was just, like, it was such good energy. I thought that was really fun.
This actually inspired me to pull up the PDF of the book because I want to read just, like, a tiny bit from her fan awakening scene. So she does this show in Schenectady. She's doing some televised performance in a theater and she's going to be filmed there. And she, on the way, like, all the streets are blocked off. And this is, I think, let's see if they have the year, 93. So we're on second album, maybe third album for Music Box, in advance of Music Box. And so Mariah is being, like, whisked through the barren streets of Schenectady. They've been all blocked off by police. And she sees fans behind barricades. And so here's a bit. I'm reading Mariah, although I will not try to do the full carry. Before I was quickly whisked into my gilded dressing room, as I am with gilded recording rooms, I caught a glimpse of crowds of people behind barricades, Though I now had a moment to settle in, I still felt anxious. Eventually, I asked why the streets were blocked off and full of police. What in the world was happening in downtown Schenectady on this hot midsummer day? Miss Carey, they told me, it's for you. It's because you were coming to do the show. Apparently, masses of young fans were crowding the streets, hoping to catch a glimpse of me, italics, her own. At first, I couldn't fully digest this response. What did they mean? ... And she goes on for about a page, having this realization that she's basically been trapped, making music, making videos, living with Tommy, having an entirely cloistered off life. And all of a sudden, she realizes that it's almost like she has this entire energy source that she didn't know that she had. And this moment in the book is kind of like, it's before the Derek Jeter thing, you know, it's before she leaves Tom. It's way before that, but it's like the first crack in the whatever was happening armor of like 90 to 93. It's the first moment of like, oh, I exist in a different way out in the world than I do in like my little bubble. I found that really moving and sort of like maybe the purest description of what it might mean to be loved by hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands or millions of people whose names you don't know, but what generative power that could give a person.
The thing that kind of impresses me about her is that you could just be the kind of person that takes all that in and lets the power just sort of wash over you. And it's something you like, you're like vampirically drawing from, but she wants to give the energy back to her fans, which I think is, and not just like in a way where she'll put on a good show, but like in these real ways where, you know, she really, really engages with her fans. So it seems more symbiotic than anything.
Yeah. And again, I'm sure a lot of artists would be grateful for the level of intense fans that Mariah has with the Lambs. I've never encountered an artist sell me on it as like an occasional skeptic of rabid fans. You know what I mean? Like, I've never had an artist actually sell me on it. So this is like, I'm just like extremely, I found it very impressive. I was really moved by it. So shouts to Mariah on that. Before we go, you want to drop any, come on. I know you got something in your pocket that you have not told anybody. Like what's a real rhythm? What's the real energy? Give me a taste. Give me a zip of goss. Give me a zip of a vibe. Give me something that the people need to know.
I feel like I gave you so many little juicy tidbits that were not
you
in the
did.
Case.
I'm not going to lie. I'm still here squeezing the last. The ketchup packet always has one more drop in it.
I got to say, and it's funny, I will end this interview the way I began this interview, talking about a hot man named Michael. Her tour manager is just smoking and like so smooth and suave and like this British accent that I was like, I'm sorry, did you like get Idris Elba to run your tours?
Wow.
Loved that guy. Really, really a charmer. She's lucky.
Is this the time to say that you are writing a book about horniness? Is this the time to say that?
I do feel like that was a great segue. Yes, thank you. I'm writing a book about horniness. Yes. But in case
this really is Podcast After Dark. It's like genuinely Podcast After Dark. It's like I'm sweating. Like I'm like a little damp. Like I honestly need like a towelette. You know what I mean? Like I just
Podcast After Dark.
Ooh, is that you, John? No,
that was Pedro. That
do
was
it Pedro. Again, Pedro. Do it again.
Podcast After Dark.
It's like Delilah, but better.
That's how I sell podcasts to people. They're like, what's podcast like? I'm like, it's like Delilah, but better.
Oh, and the one thing I will say, in case you did not want to just like let me be a complete horn dog.
No. You can be both.
Oh, thank you.
I respect your I respect your multitudes.
I appreciate that. I am a bloomin' onion. I feel like Mariah, like she really did sing so much of the interview, like she would just break into like that was like not like I didn't even put in as many times as she would just sort of like sing a sentence or sing a little ditty. But I like knowing where to look when Mariah Carey is like demonstrating whistle voice to you, like just for you, or like singing.
Oh, yeah.
It was so intense. I had no idea what to do with my eyes. So finally I was like, I'm just gonna give in and I'm gonna look at you dead in the eye while you sing to me. And it was uncomfortable and then transformative. And then I think I made her uncomfortable because she broke eye contact. So maybe I was like going a little bit too hard with the crazy eyes. She was like,
most people don't do that, Allison. Most people, FYI.
Like, look away. But I feel like if I looked too long, I would have melted. So she did me the favor of looking away.
I think I would be, if it was in your circumstance, I think I would be incinerated, starting with the eyeballs, pushing back through the optic nerves into the brain, down the spinal cord, reaching out into all the extrema, just incinerated, like just one little neuron at a time. And then I would just collapse on that into a puddle.
Well, I guess it just proves I'm stronger than you, John, but I understand. Well,
I didn't need to have you on podcast to know that, Allison. What a divine joy to have you, Allison Davis. Thank you so much.
Yeah, this is so fun. Thank you, John.
If you know anything about podcast, you know we have a tiny, eeny, weeny, weeny, weeny bit of a sweet spot for the 1990s. If you know anything about Karen Gans, you know that Karen has a very vast sweet spot for the grunge of the 90s. And so what better intersection to close out this week's episode than a quick conversation with Karen and, of course, Joe Coscarelli about the elusive Chanteuse's elusive grunge album. It's called Someone's Ugly Daughter by the band Chick. Came out in 1995, currently available on Discogs for about $120. So shout out to everybody who cooked on this album after having it sit in their promo pile for 25 years. Karen and Joe are here. Hello. What a pleasure. Hi. Miss you guys.
Hi, John. We miss you.
It's our real pleasure to be here to discuss Chick. But have we settled on grunge? Is this a grunge album?
I don't know. I'm just this. It's shorthand. I'm hashtagging it.
Yeah, it's rock and roll.
It's
alt rock, I would say.
Sure. Okay. It's an alt rock record, whatever that might have meant in 1995. Which is to say, well, Karen, explain the relationship of the sound of this record to what was going on in the early to mid 90s. Like, where did it land? Like, if you had come to it cold in 95, what would you have taxonomized it as? And what would have been the antecedents?
Well, after I answer this, I do want Joe to give you a little bit of background about how
we'll get there.
But I would say, sonically, it falls firmly in the music made by female-fronted bands from, let's say, 1992 to 1999. Although, you know, it could extend in either direction. Some reference points: Hole is a definite reference point, Elastica, Veruca Salt, L7, Belly, basically my entire record collection from the 90s. You know, I think when you're opening, I didn't take it as a read that I love the 90s so much.
It's not a read. It's a fact.
It's true. Considering how much I love that music of the 90s and how much I love Mariah Carey. This project was literally, it's like it was invented in my brain. And when information about it started leaking out, when Mariah was promoting her book, so I guess leaking isn't really the right term because she was discussing it, I could not believe how fortunate we were. I knew we were going to do this podcast. I would love to toss to Joe just so he can give us a little more factual background on what we're talking about.
I think we should defer to the woman herself, to Mariah. I have the meaning of Mariah Carey open to page 166, where she
every day. You can't, yeah. Is it like that one copy? Wait, no. Is your copy of the meaning of Mariah Carey like that one copy of like the Gutenberg Bible, where it's open to a page in the library, but then they change the page every day because they don't want to put too much pressure on the spine? Is it like that?
Except it's the opposite. So we only open to this page, so it opens automatically. You know, the spine is used to opening to page 166.
Scholars will be grateful. When you pass that on to the library system, scholars will be grateful for that ease.
When I get the tattoo of an open book that just says 166 in it, you guys will know what it's a reference to.
Speaking of references, was that a reference, Karen, to Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
Oh, it wasn't. Ooh, I didn't see it. I'm terrible. I know. I'll see it at some point.
There's a thing about keeping the book open to a certain page as a signal to a long lost lover.
Oh.
Wow.
Oh, I guess I just secreted that.
Yeah, well, I guess the answer to that question, Joe, is let's circle back in 12 months and see what we've incepted, and then we'll know.
Okay, so I just want to start by saying that this is masterful book publicity / marketing. Whoever decided that this was going to be the big reveal from the Mariah Carey book and that she was going to tweet it out with this breadcrumb trail. This book seems to have a lot of flavor, but it doesn't have a lot of dirt. Am I right, John? Like, it's,
yes,
like,
I think it's not. No, it's not in the classic kind of like tea shade room sense. Right. It's not that kind of dirt. It's familiar. Yeah. It's familiarly interesting, but it's not like gossip.
Dishy. Yeah.
I feel like the only reveals that have really had legs from it are one, that the roof is about Derek Jeter. And that, you know, that they had this very literal
wet
romance.
Yes.
That she then turned into a song, which, like, people knew, obviously, that she dated Jeter, but not, maybe not this level of detail. And then second, that she recorded this album in 1995 while she was recording Daydream. So she also does this amazing thing in the book where she doesn't name the band even. So we're coming at this part of the story where her relationship to Tommy Mottola is rocky at best. You know, it's like 1994, 95. She's recording Daydream. And she actually uses the Fantasy remix as like the jumping off point, where she talks about how sort of like exploring new musical genres, in that case, hip hop with Old Dirty Bastard and the remix, sort of like got this experimental part of her going. And also how she was basically feeling like she was suffocating during Daydream. She said she was in desperate need of relief. And that she basically started an alter ego. She calls it her Ziggy Stardust-like spoof band.
Her Chris Gaines. Her Chris Gaines.
Yeah, I'm going to read a little bit. My character was a dark-haired, brooding goth girl. And then she says in a parenthetical, a version of her, Bianca, showed up a few years later in the Heartbreaker video. And Bianca wrote and sang ridiculous, tortured songs. She calls it her little alt-rock song. She says, I was playing with the style of the breezy, grunge, punk light, white female singers who were popular at the time. You know, the ones who seemed to be so carefree with their feelings and their image. They could be angry, angsty, and messy with old shoes, wrinkled slips, and unruly eyebrows. Hi, Courtney Love. While every move I made was so calculated and manicured, I wanted to break free, let loose, and express my misery. But also, I wanted to laugh.
Old shoes.
It's like, and wrinkled slips. It's just like unbelievable.
Garen, when you write your history of this era, old shoes and wrinkled slips, it's going to be the title. It's going to be the title.
She talks about how, you know, she basically got Tommy to make her a boutique record label called Crave, which is taken from the lyrics to the song Demented on this Chick album. And that, you know, she signed one rap group called the Negro League, who cameo in the Roof video. And then the other band was Chick. And Chick ended up being fronted by her friend Clarissa, who I guess was her roommate around this time. But Mariah claims that there is a version of this album in which she sings lead. And now she says she may be trying to dig that up and release it. I think it's very likely that this music will get re-released because it was uploaded on YouTube once the fans figured out all the details and who exactly was involved in this and which album she was talking about, even though she doesn't name it. But now all of the illegal uploads have been scrubbed. They sort of pop up a little bit whack-a-mole style, but it's basically impossible to find unless you want to pay three figures for it. But there is a Vevo channel. There is a Chick Vevo channel with two music videos, one for Malibu, again, shout out to Courtney Love, one for a song called Demented. And this band existed.
We should listen to a little bit of Demented. We opened with a Karen preference, which is Love is a Scam. We transitioned in. But let's catch a little bit of Demented right now.
Yeah. something that we're gonna have to get into, is just like the way that these songs reference almost every trope of 90s music. And that one starts with this like slow arpeggiated guitar riff. It's amazing.
I did some deep digging on this because it almost felt too good to be true. And there seemed to be literally no one who remembered this album from the time it was released. Even just the people we have here, Karen, John, you guys have been in this business a long time. Ben Cesario, another person who works with us, who's very into 90s alt rock and has been in the game forever. He had no memory of this. No one could find it in their promo piles. John Perales has pretty much every piece of music ever recorded. I don't think he could find it. But I dug up a Reddit post from 3 years ago where someone says, "Does anyone know where I can stream the album Someone's Ugly Daughter by Chick?" And talks about how their brother's girlfriend used to rave about it when they were a kid, talking about it like it was the biggest band ever. And they'd never been able to find it again. But in this post mentioned something that I think Karen also found, which is that a Chick video featured on Beavis and Butthead at some point in the mid-90s.
Oh, wow.
If anyone can dig that clip up, please hit the podcast email, podcast@nytimes.com.
And the Facebook group.
Yes, and the Facebook group. It's just a treat. It's just a treat. And the first song on the album is called Joe, so I'm already endeared to it from the jump.
I was going to ask you about that one, Joe.
Given the era of its birth, I think the mid-90s, we were not yet at whatever thing we are at now, like post-100 Gex, which is to say like post ironic embrace of musical styles that maybe seem incompatible with performers or whatever. You know, we weren't at that place at the time. Does this album at all, if you had encountered it then, does this album scan as parodic at all? Does it scan as sincere? Does it scan as musically in the exact same kind of like between the cushions that all those other bands that you were talking about? Do you feel like you can feel the textural difference at all?
I think if I had received it absolutely cold in the 90s, I would have thought it was of a, you know, of a piece with everything else that I was listening to. Listening to it now with knowledge that Mariah was involved, you hear it with more of a wink. But it's not like a mean wink. I feel like it's a really affectionate wink. And like when it hit the internet that first day and Joe and Ben and I were slacking about it, we were like really marveling at how closely it approximates all of these conventions of the music, these close minor harmonies. I think the least effective thing was sometimes it switches to double time. They're not very good at doing that punky double time thing. But like the harmonies, there are 90s references. There's a reference to Melrose Place in Malibu, which by the way preceded Courtney Love's Malibu by 3 years. The whole one came out in 1998. Also, Someone's Ugly Daughter just totally scans as America's Sweetheart to me, which was the Courtney album that came out in 2004. It's like she was writing a path for Courtney. It's just, it's almost too good. But yeah, just the ethereal vocals, the like vocal that kind of like strains off into like a fried, you know, expiration. It's just so close. It's like she had to have been, if she or Clarissa or whoever was involved with this, obviously was very well acquainted with the music of the time. And it was extremely popular. You know, like we look at it now as sort of like quaint and nostalgic, but like grunge was literally everywhere. Alt rock was everywhere. You know, you threw a rock and you hit a song like this.
The style was popular enough. I mean, here's Mariah Carey, like arguably the most popular performer in any genre in America in that era. It's on her radar and it's popular enough for her to, whether it's satirical or not, whether it's a kind of like a lark or not, it's a style that she felt she saw herself in, even if it was just some part of herself. This wasn't an obscure choice. Like she didn't make some avant-garde side project.
Yeah, these things didn't exactly exist in harmony. You couldn't really be a pop fan and an alt-rock fan in the 90s and say like, I'm an omnivore. I like all these things. You know, like these things were definitely in competition with each other.
Two things I will say about that. One, yes, she presaged some of the Courtney Love stuff, but Live Through This is a platinum album. That came out right around the time that this would have been being made. That album came out in spring of 94, I believe. So,
oh yeah, you know, it's definitely an influence, sure.
Like Hole was definitely having their breakthrough moment. At the same time, someone like Mariah, who's one of the best songwriters to ever live, something that I've learned just being in the studio over the years with people is like the best songwriters are often also the best mimics. Like they can just spot on create a song in any style at any given time. And I think that that's really what you're hearing here is like Mariah is such a musical genius that she could probably hear one whole song and then make her own version of that. But I'm wondering if you guys hear Mariah in this, because it's reported that she did some background vocals on it and on this version that we've heard. But I don't really hear Mariah. Do you guys hear Mariah in this?
I don't. And I will say one of the striking things about the book, there are a number of segments in the book where she includes long passages of lyrics, right? And usually she's doing it to underscore a point, you know, or underscore a moment. Here's a thing that happened. Here are the lyrics I wrote about it. And the thing about Mariah as a songwriter, we think about songwriters as lyricists, but we also have to remember songwriters are melodists. Songwriters are arrangers or part of big contributors to the arrangements. Sometimes you would look at these lyrics on paper and be like, well, this is a nice enough story. But then when you would hold it up to the actual Mariah, the version of it, it's an entirely different universe. The words in Mariah's songwriting are by no means the whole thing. I think there are certain singer-songwriter type folks who 90% of what they're achieving is in the words. It's in the wordplay. It's in the syllabic choices and rhythms. With Mariah, so much of the work is that's the bass, and then the voice is doing overtime. On a pure word level, I'm not sure I could have identified any of this stuff as Mariah. And I agree, Joe, with what you're saying vocally. Obviously, if there is a version with her singing lead, I want to hear that because I want to hear the parts of Mariah applied to this style. But I don't hear it super heavy on this album.
I can hear it. I mean, like, I don't know if I'm hallucinating it.
Do you want to hear it?
It's possible, but like, even with the song we opened with, you know, when the Love is a Scam, the I Don't Really Give a Damn with it all drawn out, I hear Mariah in that. I hear her in the most Elastica-y song, Freak, with the line, like, I couldn't tell if she was black, white, or chartreuse. I don't know. That's like, to me, that's like Mariah joking. Sort of ethereal vocal to Agony, the seventh song. I hear Mariah in that, too. I wasn't sure if she was singing backing vocals on this stuff or what, or if I was hallucinating it, but I don't know. I agree with what you're saying about her lyric writing. You know, she is a very specific storytelling kind of a writer too. But to me, this is her, like what Joe was saying, like doing an experiment, a thought experiment, like I can do this.
I guess my takeaway is, Karen, when you do your 33 and a third on this album, right? Fair. When you do the 33 and a third, I know you'll get under the hood and really both get the full backstory and also the full critical appreciation of someone's ugly daughter.
Yes. So, you know, we have been doing some digging, trying to get the full backstory. There was an interview in Rolling Stone with one of the engineers, I believe, who worked on the album, recording engineers. I've spoken to a separate engineer who worked on the album, and we have tracked down the credited singer, Clarissa Dane, who is now a family photographer in Florida. And she's a very sweet woman, but she is a little freaked out by this rush of attention. But we'll see if we can get her to speak by the end of the year. The one point I wanted to make on the question of whether it's like parody or not is one of the things it reminds me most of in the world is the Josie and the Pussycats soundtrack from 2001.
Nice.
Which I think is extremely influential. A great record. It's produced by Babyface. It features writing from Adam Duritz, writing from Adam Schlesinger also. Like, this is just like an amazing thing. And the vocals are the woman from Letters to Cleo, Kay Hanley, who,
yes,
again, is like Letters to Cleo. There's a lot of Letters to Cleo in this album. Ben Cesario also mentioned that when he first heard it. But yeah, Three Small Words from Josie and the Pussycats came, you know, 5-6 years later, but what a banger.
You know, in the 90s, a person like me felt divided. You know, it was very difficult to be a pop fan and an alt-rock fan at the same time. And it was really exemplified in the very memorable Madonna-Courtney Love meeting at the VMA's red carpet with Kurt Loder. I'm sure you're all familiar with this clip. But these genres and these sounds did meet only a few short years later in the music that we all love so much of Ashley Simpson. You know, and Avril Lavigne. It really did. It was such that was the blend of the pop sensibility with this kind of alt rock guitars and songwriting styles. And I just wanted to tie it all together by saying, this is us.
Yes,
it really is. Guys, what a pleasure. Thanks for calling in. I am happy to talk to you about the foundations of our taste profile.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you, John. It was a pleasure.
That's our show. Thank you to Allison. Thank you to Karen. Thank you to Joe. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us any questions, podcast@nytimes.com, or get on the Facebook group and drop a conversation starter. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get audio. You know what those places are. Our producer, as ever, is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. Let's go out with one of my favorite examples of pure Mariah sentiment. And if you know what's going on, you know who this is for. This is Hero.